The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 175, Making Connections and Seeing Beyond the Box, a conversation with Rick Furie. Interviewee is Richard Furie. The interviewer is Albert Peck.
Symposium, Making Connections and Seeing Beyond the Box. A conversation with Rich Furie. We see this as a conversation. Rich and I meet at lunch every now and then, and we have wide-ranging conversations about all sorts of things, and they're fun, and we decide to let everyone else overhear these conversations and join in if they have questions. To help the audience know who you are, tell us who you are.
Can you hear all right? Is there a problem with the mic?
There's a little hum.
It's the rain. Is it better now?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll just try to get closer. I'm Rich Furie. I'm a practicing child psychiatrist at the University of Utah Medical School, a division of child and adolescent psychiatry. I also work at Primary Children's Medical Center. I'm the chairman of the department there. I've worked with children and adolescents now since 1976 around issues of emotional and psychiatric issues, and also I have done quite a bit of work for advocacy for children in the community relative to community services and the application of mental health criteria in helping children through programs like Families and Agencies Coming Together. It's called FACT. That's a Utah group that's coordinating services for children, as well as the Board of Mental Health and other kinds of community input. Jan's reminding me that the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is a program for mental health parity, has recently been part of what I've been working on with the governor's office in improving the capacity for us to move toward parity in mental health, particularly. Now we have this program for children. It's not parity yet, but it's moving in that direction. And I also have spent some time working with the church on issues. I'm working with the missionary committee. That committee is working on improving the capacity for the church to respond to emotional mental illness among missionaries. And that's been an exciting opportunity over the last 2 years. And also spent time working with the church in their views and responses to the issue of homosexuality and members of the church who are in that situation. So it's kind of a lot of issues that keep sort of, I think, people wondering about where are the boundaries, where do you go, what needs to be changed, what needs attention. And it seems to me that in the face of suffering, in the face of disabilities, in the face of situations where people's lives are really affected by adverse circumstances, things which they change, we ought to be in that fight with them. But the greater fight, of course, is to be in the place of trying to discover with another human being the capacity they have to take control and mastery over their own life. So, is that all right?
It's amazing how he does this with so many people. Rich is one of the busiest people I know. He calls and says, let's get together. And between all these committee meetings, the people he's consulting privately, the friends he's helping on his principal day, listening and talking, he's one of the most passionate, caring, engaged people I know. And he does this hours nonstop. This is impressive. Well, one of the things we talk about that you're very passionate about is the relationship between the spirit,
right.
You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the key piece here is that it seems... Yeah, why don't we do that? That'll work. It's easier to talk to somebody. You know, the whole thing is, you know, one of my great metaphors is the road to Emmaus. And I'll talk about that a little bit later, but when it really gets down to it, I mean, how many journeys do you want to take alone? And for me, there's a place in life where you have a certain amount of solitude. If you don't grapple with your own aloneness and your own capacity to manage that solitude in the sense of who you are in relationship to what you choose to be, regardless of what anybody else tells you you are, at some point you don't have the power within your own life to act independent in relationship to others. That whole thing about codependency. But on the other hand, to be alone without the ability to make that connection with other people, that is, develop the relationships that enhance the capacity to really understand yourself as a person. You really can't stretch, at least I've not learned how to stretch, until you've actually confronted yourself in relationship to another person and tried to somehow create that relationship in which you let go of control, let go of your own need states to have that person be an extension of yourself, and grapple with what it means simply to be there in relationship to the other person, you listening, a part of the experience. Well, to me, the metaphor for that is Emmaus, and how two people in conversation, you know, engage. And as they are engaging in that conversation, and as they are engaging in that moment of real connection, you know, Christ joins them. And truly it seems to me that if the capacity for true connection occurs in a relationship, there is something absolutely real about the Spirit joining into that relationship at that point in time that transcends that moment and takes it beyond what it might have otherwise been. So, to me, key aspects of life revolve around that struggle, but tension between what is my identity and who am I, to have control and mastery over who I am, but in the service of creating relationships that expand my ability to be me, because I give up pieces of myself in order to make that connection occur. Well, one of the things that you struggle with then is trying to understand what degrees of freedom you have. One of the great church leaders who talks about this is Elder Oaks, who, in his views of looking at the human personality, is very concerned about what is agency and what is not agency, and the degree to which we have power and control over it. And I bring this up because that was one of the great issues he struggled with in relationship to the gay issue. I mean, just as one way of thinking about it. I mean, how much of that is the physical construct of the mind and its genetic predispositions or the learning experiences that may have occurred before a child has the capacity to simply gain an ability to understand who they are, and so have absorbed from their environment ways of thinking and feeling, so that by the time they're, quote, eight, we now leave the garden because they've taken of the fruit, they've passed eight, they've been baptized, and now suddenly they have agency. But what agency do they have in relationship to what they were given? Children who, for instance, have been abused, children who have had attachment problems and who have not learned trust. I mean, how do you know God if you can't trust a human being here on this earth? It's very hard to know how to trust God if you've never had that loving care of someone rocking you gently and caring for you at that moment, so that within your own body, within your own psyche, and believe me, within your own nervous system, your brain has a capacity to find a place where it can find soothing and calming experiences and gain mastery over an experience of feeling stimulated and at times out of control. So that whole issue, you know, what is agency and what is not agency? And what do we have control over? Well, Ellerich says, okay, but there may be a place where we have what he calls susceptibilities. Susceptibilities, that is the tendencies that we some inherit that lead towards certain behaviors. And when those susceptibilities become intentions over which we have some control due to our feelings and our thinking process to make a determination about what behaviors we're going to experience because of that. And it's fascinating because, as you well know, in the last 10 years, we probably know more about the brain than we've known since the beginning of time, at least in this stage of affairs. And there's so many fascinating things to understand about how it works. Just the fact that we know something about serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine have opened our minds to incredible possibilities of understanding what this computer is doing for us and what it's not. There was a mother, just as a quick example of who has what freedom, who brought their child in. And this is a history now, genetically, starting from three generations ago. The mother before, this is the great-grandmother, had significant depression. The next generation, mother of this mother, had a type of what we call borderline condition in which she was so unable to modulate her feeling states that she was always extending damage to her children in relationship to the fact that she expected them to feel what she felt. And if they didn't feel it, they weren't competent. They weren't responding to her. It's that wonderful statement, you know, when you say, you know, it's cold outside, you need to put a coat on. Well, how do you know? Well, I was out there and it was cold. And you said, well, therefore you're cold. No, I don't feel cold. I'm fine. Put your coat on. It's cold outside. All right, you know. In other words, how I feel determines how my children need to feel. And who I am is what I want to extend to my children to become like I am. Well, there's an environmental set that starts limiting agency, and you get confused. And the daughter got confused, and she went through enormous pain through her childhood because not only did this message from her mother occur, but she was also in the same state of having a lot of anxiety that was probably serotonin-based. Serotonin is that neurotransmitter that has to do with calming and soothing and the ability to feel all right. Well, she's gone through that, and you know, she's married and she has two children. One of them is two. And this child seems to just fall apart at the drop of a hat. Just cries, screams. If she'll pick her up and hold her for about 5 minutes, she'll be able to kind of calm down and she'll feel a little bit better. But then, you know, as time goes on, you know, minute, you know, she's away from mother, she's back, you know, tugging at her and saying, you know, I, Mom, what are you doing? What are you doing? And so on and so forth. And so all day long, it's cry, scream, tug, crash. You know, cry, scream, cry. And mother is just overwhelmed. And so then she gets pregnant, has a second child. Second child is now 3 months old. And this child, you know, when she sees the child, is hitting the child and so on and so forth. You know, this kind of sibling rivalry that you might expect. But they're all aghast. They're all amazed. This child, this little boy, 3 months along now, perfectly quiet. Couldn't be happier, smiling all the time. Seems to really generate a sense of wonder about life. And they're already saying, isn't he great? Aren't we happy for him? Wish he'd go away. And what was not so subtle becomes pretty evident, that this child who's so negatively reacting to so many situations is starting to create a negative emotional set on the part of her parents. Now dad comes home, and he comes home because he's the new person on the block, and you've never seen this happen, but sometimes kids are this way, you know, maybe not yours. And they see dad, and they, oh, I'm so glad to see you. And the minute the daughter sees dad, she runs up and grabs dad, and then kicks mother, and says what a terrible person she is. And dad begins to keep wondering, now, who's right here? Is this a terrible mother? I mean, why is this child out of control? What is she doing wrong? How can she be so terrible? Then he takes the daughter away, and they go, and he said, we went to the ice cream store, and we had a really wonderful time. She didn't give me a bit of look of trouble. So I don't know what's going on. And it's probably the mother. Now, where is the agency there in that particular daughter? And how is that beginning to construct a sense within this child that she somehow is limited because of the way she affects people in getting a sense of gratification? I mean, how gratified is she when mother is distressed to this level? And where does that? What does that do to her nervous system? Three major things that these kids have got to learn in their limbic brain. They got to learn how to affect state manage. If they don't know how to manage that mood state, the energy state about feeling high energy, low energy, depression, or hypomania. That's a gee, I'm really happy. I can be happier. And gee, I don't need to sleep. And I got a lot of ideas. And my judgment's kind of off, but I'm fine. You know, that's when you get a little too much energy. You know, or really low and can't sleep and you're still struggling. The other is the capacity to self-care, which means a certain capacity to anticipate consequences. That's the anxiety part of our brain, which sort of says, you know, you got a problem, you need to solve it. So the chemistry affects our sense of doing that. And the other is self-governance, the ability to step outside yourself and see and manage those particular factors that affect how you feel. Well, in the face of these kinds of stresses, the child loses it in the sense of feeling like that she can manage and do very well. And so she not only experiences it, but she learns that she's not valued, and she also doesn't learn to self-soothe. And anyway, the bottom line was when we got there, the mother said, do anything you can to help her. And I said, She probably has some problems with this genetic predisposition. I said, can you accept the fact that these are two different children? And they said, yes, we can accept the fact that the temperaments are different. The father said, I just think she needs better care. And the mother said, and if you think that, I'm leaving. And who's right? You know, the problem is, I'm this man who's supposed to look in a black box and figure it out, right? I mean, I can't take the brain overnight and do studies on it and give it back the next day. And so you've got to make these judgments about where is the agency in that child? Is she really trying to control? Is she really that angry with her mother? And has mother really failed? Or has the child set up a situation that over time has defeated mother's ability to somehow manage to maintain this state? Well, all I'm saying is there are susceptibilities. And I think this child has one of those. And I think there are many of these susceptibilities that we can be quite judgmental about. And how much damage do we do when we make the decisions about what a person can control and what they can't control? And in this situation, when I offered medication to the husband, he said, no, I can't do that. And the wife said, well, you know, I don't see how I'm going to do it any differently. And he said, I will quit my job to take care of this child. Now, I said, and how is your wife going to feel about that, you know? And we had a longer discussion, obviously. That was not the way to end it. But I said, you know, I don't think the answer is for you to quit your job. Although, I bet you if I said you needed to do that, you wouldn't. Because it was more a message of inadequacy on his wife's part that he was saying he was going to quit his job than he really knew what to do with his child. Well, there really are those factors that lead us to have temperament states and feelings that make it extraordinarily difficult to know where do we actually have agency and where does the brain take over and give us this difficulty in our ability to use it. I mean, I've seen a lot of young people, just as an example, who take and use their computers all day long and with high degrees of stimulus and never go to bed and stay up till 2 or 3 in the morning. They love self-stimulation. It's about computers. It's about Nintendo. I mean, even Jay Leno is a kind of pathetic, but a stimulus nonetheless. And they're going through all of this, and pretty soon, you know, their little computers are just sort of really wired. And they're so aroused, you know, it punches up. Actually, we've seen kids do this. They watch the Nintendo for a long period of time, and they get more irritable. It's because they increase their norepinephrine levels. And it's sort of like drinking too much coffee, and they tend to be a little bit more violent, a little more irritable. Well, that's what, you know, it's at 2 o'clock at night, a little more violent, a little more irritable, doesn't sleep very well. And the next morning, they don't make it too well to school. And then they wonder why their computer is not doing too well. And when they sit down in class and the teacher says, put this software in, think, you know, and it's not thinking. So anyway, I know that's too long of an introduction. But the issue is that I think there is an enormous importance in us trying to understand what God has given to us in this earthly frame that we have to manage in order for our lives to make sense. And that there are ways in which we can manage our brains that will give us more degrees of freedom. And one of the things that people tend to have the more difficulty managing is their emotional aspects, the limbic system and the emotional aspects of their brain that puts those kind of limits in their ability to express their agency. If you actually can, you know, calm down sometimes, and you're not just bent on stimulation or consumption as a way to deal with life, then sometimes you actually have more agency.
Well, you excite me when you say those things. Because then people, then what do I do with either my own life or a friend if I see these situations? You know, if you talk to a traditional Orthodox Mormon, their response would be the person who's having struggle with this is you need to keep the commandments better, you need to pray more, you need to serve more, you know, get involved in those sorts of things, and then you'll feel the spirit and there'll be a fix. What do you think about that dynamic?
Well, the dynamic I'd like to respond to here is that one of the best fixes is the discovery of your inner self's ability at times to transcend what appears to be your limitations. And
say
I.
That again.
Okay. That was not well said.
No, I was following, but it was okay.
I really believe in the divine that exists in everybody. I get with people. And things will happen that give me a sense that there's something inside there that's different than they've been experiencing in their previous experience. And somehow, if they can tap into this piece, this old, you know, and we've heard it from sages, we've heard it from philosophers, and we've heard it from all kinds of religions, that there's this kind of union, even people are saying, hey, there's this old kind of person. And we talk about the pre-existence, and we talk about there's a kind of divine spark. But I really believe that it's true, that there is this peace that somehow is beyond our susceptibilities, that is greater than our physical, and probably even more than our learning, old enough and wise enough by its feeling state, if we can get a hold of it, that will be able to help us discern what is the good and what is not good enough to be able to make the decisions to make it different. So that if you can tap into that piece of a person, you know, they come alive to a different sense of themselves. Just as an example, you know, there's this wonderful young woman who's been struggling with her family for years. Now, in this family, there is also a genetic predisposition. And she has a problem on one side of the family where there's obsessive compulsive disorder, and we've discovered that that has something to do with serotonin, and it has something to do with the prefrontal cortex and the setting up of problems with that. And another side of the family, which is just plain old depression, and standard sense of problems with norepinephrine and serotonin, and you increase those and she does better. But she struggled all of her life to get in control of all of this. Well, long story short, she's failed at school, she's failed here, and now she's about ready to emancipate. And she's really struggling with emancipation because, number one, she's depressed. Number two, she's not felt supported by the fact that she's sort of been the black sheep of the family. And all of these things have sort of collapsed in on her until the whole year of college she fails and she's going nowhere. And finally she just says, there's only one solution, you know. By the way, she was put on some medication and there was some benefit through increasing her serotonin level to help her some. But anyway, she goes away to college, for a summer, and she becomes a nanny. She becomes a nanny in a faraway city. And, you know, she struggles and she struggles and struggles. Well, she has a problem with cigarettes. And in the process of smoking, and she goes to an LDS family, and of course, that's a big mistake. If you're going to be a nanny to children and you have cigarettes that you hide and don't tell people about, you know, somehow there's a smoke. Anyway, by the time she's put in a couple of months, the family's had it. And one day they tell her, you're out of here, unless you can get rid of this problem. Well, she doesn't quite get rid of the problem, they send her home. And the parents say, here she is, she's failed again. She's, you know, we sent her away, she didn't do well at school, now here we are, she's home and she's failed again. She comes in, and this is what I'm telling you. She comes in and she says, I had a wonderful summer. Her parents said, what? She said, and I'm talking to her, and my office just had a wonderful summer. She said, it was about the best summer I can ever remember. And I said, you know, you were smoking. She said, I had a wonderful summer. Tell me about the summer. You know, tell her parents to be quiet for a minute, okay? She said, I really engaged with these children. Someone said I couldn't work with children. She says, I was so happy to get up every morning, and I ran out and took these children, and we went to the store, and we went to the beach, and we did this, and we did that, and we did this. And she describes these enormously exciting experiences that she had had with these children. And I said, well, what was the parents' reaction to this? And she said, they thought I was really quite wonderful. I said, really? You know, you actually could tell her things. Yes, but da-da-da. And she said, you know what else? I got a job on my own. You know, and then she describes, she said, it was at the end of the summer, and I was doing all of these things. And one day I was trying to find my friends, and there was no way to find any friends. There was no one around, and there was nothing for me to do. And she said, so I decided to go out to the beach, and they were having fireworks. It was the 4th of July. And she said, there was no one there, but there was this huge crowd. And so she walks up, and I said, I went to the front of the crowd, And as I stood between these two peoples, I suddenly realized I was completely and entirely alone. And I didn't have anybody around but me. And she said, and on the side of me was a young man and their family. And we started talking. And on the other side was another family with two children. And she said, before it was over, I was like a part of their family. She said, it was the most exciting experience of my life. I said, it was fireworks. She said, yes. I said, it was liberation. She said, yes. I said, it was the 4th of July. She said, yes. I said, you did it all on your own. Yes. You weren't a failure. Yes. And did you love it? Yes. And then she said, I remember my patriarchal blessing. And in my patriarchal blessing, it said that I would be able to love and care for people, and that my strengths are service and motherhood and leadership. She said, I don't have any of those in my life. And I said, would you just sit and go back through this with me again? What did you do with these children? She said, I loved them. And then what did you do? I served them. And then what did you do? You led them. And they followed you. You were the Pied Piper all summer long. It even happened that when you visited these other people, standing there on that beach with the fireworks going off, they were going off in you too. And nothing could suppress the wonder of what it was to be you. And she just started to cry. There was something in her that I can't make happen, you can't make happen, and something that will transcend even those genetics at some point, if there's a piece of ourselves we can grab a hold of that will make that kind of a connection to our best self. And what I discover is that people have their different metaphors. But when I talk to her, ever since I've ever seen it, I'll look at her and I'll say, how are you doing? She'll say, fine. I said, have you had any fireworks lately? And she'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Because we were there. She and I, as we were talking, were standing on the beach, and she was re-experiencing what it was like to be free, to feel herself completely alive, to a new experience, and have it work. And work completely without anybody being critical of her and having that experience. She's ready to take her journey on. I mean, she's no longer a child. And her parents keep saying, you can't do it. And she said, I can do this. But, of course, what they see is the child. And they don't see that she's proven that she can do all of the things she says she wants to do. But what I have discovered, and I'm sure you've discovered it too, that when God gives you that kind of a witness, and I don't know whether it's God or it's just the universe of spirit that gives you the witness about what it means to love another person, and you see them for the truth of who they are, it never changes. And I always know that there'll be fireworks when I see her. And I always know that piece that we both shared together, in her seeing her patriarchal blessing and my being able to see it in exactly the same way the patriarch did, in the sense that I saw her as that person that he saw, is definitely going to be the capacity that she has to become what she needs to be.
That is exciting. I hear you talk about both the things you talked about, the individual becoming aware, working things out on your own, and also the connection and relationship. You're there, engaged, friendship. See, part of that connecting relationship is the sharing of each other's journey, listening, caring, being with them in their journey. Can I talk about journeys and how you do that with each other?
Well, you probably, you know about Joseph Campbell, and you know about the hero's journey, and how that the mythology of time has come down in teaching all of us what it means to be alive to the discovery of our best selves. And it seems to me that, I mean, there are people who sit and wonder about how wonderful it would be to know Princess Diana. And I mean, I am serious. I mean, I watch all these people putting flowers, you know, and spending oodles amount of time in the pursuit of celebrities. And in this particular case, you know, what was her life? You know, frankly, and to be honest with you, her life was a metaphor for perhaps going in the wrong direction. You know, there's a certain amount of pursuit of power that leads to the end of a dark tunnel. And so it really is amazing to me for people to perceive looking for some other place to have that happen, but not within themselves. Well, Joseph Campbell, and I think rightly so, through the centuries, the traditions of the fathers who passed on stories and the shamanic experiences and the spiritual experiences of all communities have taught these same kind of things about what it means to be in touch with yourself and to create, you know, your own journey as far as discovery about who it is you are. And I think part of it is the willingness, you know, to be in touch with how you really feel. And I think sometimes that's hard to do without someone to connect with you. But I think the biggest problem, of course, is connecting with your best self, which is having some courage, as this girl finally did, to say, you know, that really did work, and that was okay, and I feel good about that piece of myself, and I feel called, she said. And the first thing that happens is there's a preparation, and then the Joseph Campbell, you know, then there's this call, and the call said, I've got to go do this thing. And then there's the journey to discover whether you actually can accomplish it. And usually for most women, the call comes, and the task is ultimately to have compassion over wants and over needs, and over the ability to claim for yourself, loving others in the way that restores you and heals you, because you can love in ways that give you back your own soul. It's all kinds of trials about how are you going to make those things happen. And eventually, when you've broken your heart sufficiently over that, those aspects of giving yourself to those pieces of the journey, do you finally claim you know, the capacity to give something back. So how does that happen? Well, I think sometimes it would happen better if we were more willing to look at each other and be willing, instead of, see, one of the things the girl was struggling with, she says, I can't stand BYU. Well, what's wrong with BYU? It's a great school. You know, lots of people go there. You could possibly get married if you're lucky. You know, there's a certain limitation to our cultural views about what is success, you know. I'm a cheerleader at BYU, and I'm going to get married tomorrow, you know. Well, that's great, but it didn't work for this girl, you know. It just didn't, you know. She says, this other culture worked for me, you know. And if we listen to other people and where they're going, you know, because we connect with their heart, I think we'd be less likely to judge, you know, what they say is what they, you know, what we think they need because the world says that's what they're supposed to have. And it's not about principle. You see, I think Joseph Smith had it right. Teach them correct principles and they govern themselves. Well, teach them correct principles and they'll find themselves. But it's not about rules and it's not about everybody else's culture. It's about the principle-based. I mean, where was Jesus going? You know, I think the greatest message that Jesus, I thought, taught was the message to be in the present and try to discover who you are right here and now. And, of course, I always talk about the millennial Christ and Jesus of Bethany. You know, millennial Christ, he's coming back. I mean, it's the year 2000. I hope you're all ready because you're going to get burned if you're not, right? You know, and tithing is the insurance against the burning. So 10% is pretty good. But for those who want a higher place in the stands when he comes, a little more consecration would be helpful. But the biggest deal about his coming is that I can tell you who he's not going to welcome. He's not going to welcome the polygamous in Manti. He's not going to welcome the NRA and not Charlton Heston. And he's not going... Those guys are going to get burned. If you have a gun in your pocket, it will melt like lead onto your skin. And you will feel this incredible pain that you can't just imagine. And you're saying, oh my God, I really shouldn't have had a gun or a concealed weapon at all. And so, you see, the great thing about Christ coming is he takes care of all my problems. I mean, those gun-toting people... You know, and, you know, these right-wingers. And I can tell you, I can't tell you. It's not fair. But there are some people on the right who bother me quite a bit. And it would be nice, you know, to think that in the year 2000, there will be a systematic very carefully reduction of the Newt Gingriches and so forth, you know, on their way to hell. Well, now,
so that's the millennial
class. That's the millennial class. I think the Jews kind of looked for that, you know? They thought, gee, he's going to come down and do all of this stuff. And that's not what he was doing. You know, the most wonderful thing was he sat with Mary, and Mary said, I want to know about you. I want to know who you are. And he said, well, why don't you sit with me, and let's just talk. And Martha was a little busy, and she said, you know, Mary, you know, come on, help me. And she was busy about preparation, and Mary was busy about connecting. And Christ, of course, said, you know, she's chosen the better part. And he wasn't critical of Martha, just said, you know, I think there's something here you're missing. And here's Mary again, and Jesus. And before, you know, his death, and before his burial, she knows him so well. I don't think it's because he sits and tells her all these things. She feels who he is. And when she's at his feet, she lays her head on his feet and washes his feet with oil. The oil that Judas says should be given to the poor. And she says, but, you know, I don't have my friend always. He's leaving me. She knew he was leaving. She knew he was going. And she wanted to be with him for that moment, at that point in time, without giving herself to any future that could particularly control or change her fears about his leaving. She was going to claim that moment. Because in claiming that moment, there would be no regrets. When he was gone, she could say, no, I was there, and I know him. And he knows that I loved him. And whatever best I had, I gave. And I washed his feet with that oil. I mean, in anticipation of the same way he would love and take care of his apostles when he washed their feet. She had done it previous to that thing. Where would she get that intuitive sense? Where does she know this kind of thing? How can she feel that if she didn't connect with him at that particular moment? And so she's sort of saying, you know, this is the Jesus I love. You know, and I'm going to miss him, you know? And the resurrection and all that, of course, is enormously important. But what he was saying was, you need to love now, here, intensely. Be part of what it means to know someone else. Because when you can do that, you claim your own soul, and you really understand who I am. I mean, when he's on the road to Emmaus, they're talking, and he's opening the scriptures to them. And they're so excited about it that when he says, I'm going to leave, and he says, you know, why don't you tarry with us? And he says, no, he was going to leave. And they said, no, come on in. And so they went in, and they supped together. I remember, what a wonderful metaphor. When the conversation and the connection becomes that good, you know, we want him to be with us always, and we want that spirit, and we want that feeling, and that's what she wanted, and that's what she wanted to feel when she was with him. And so they sat and supped, and then, of course, when they were supping together, he broke bread and gave it to them. He fed them. He fed them. He fed them spiritual. And when they were so fed, and when they were so filled with the Spirit, when they could feel to the sense that they were so enlivened, their minds were open, and they saw who it was. And it was Jesus Christ. And when they saw him, he was gone. And the point, of course, is that when we feel that much love for another person, we see in them Christ. For in loving another person, ye have done the same to him as you would do to any other person. He said, inasmuch as you've done it on one of the least of these, you've done it unto me. It wasn't just a do-good thing to get points. It wasn't just adding up things in order to be okay and say, Jesus, I went to prison, I did all this, and I did all those other kinds of things. See, I got points. I went home teaching. I got 6 on my list, and I got 100%. No. He says, if you really love them, it's as though you love me, because you love them in a way that will transcend your own experience, because you want to be with them, and you want to share with them, and you want to feel this thing, and to be in their presence. And when you're there, the Spirit is there. And when the Spirit is there, you'll know that I am there, because I am that Spirit of love. And so at that moment, you don't need to see his face. I mean, he's gone because he's not there to be seen. Because feeling him is seeing him more than you could possibly ever understand by simply looking. Because the Spirit has the capacity for vision beyond what one can see. And in that spirit of truth, love goes beyond what anyone ever can literally see. And what they said, of course, was, did not our hearts burn within us when he was with us in the way? Yeah. Yeah.
I have a relationship with friends where I think what you say describes lot of people who my relationships aren't like that. How many people can I reasonably connect with on that level? And if I can't connect with everyone, how should my relationships be constructed with those other people? I mean, I'm not in the present.
Well, how bad do you want it?
Some people I really want it. Others, I'm not that interested, I guess.
I mean, there's a lot of things about desire, isn't it? You know, I think it's a question of how bad you want it. Because it's not an easy job, is it? It's not an easy task. Let's ask a mother, you know, which of those children did she not want? And the only reason I'm saying that is because there's this piece of striving with someone through thick and thin that somehow eventually breaks our heart. That takes us to places maybe we would have never gone had we not broken our hearts over it. And wanted that connection above everything else. And I don't know whether it's 5 kids. I don't know if it's 10. Some women break their heart over far more than that. So I don't know what the capacity is. I think the capacity is probably more limitless than we think. We live in a world that's all about consumption of scarcity. Remember, it's the scarcity principle. There's not enough, and so we have to climb to the top. You know, there's not enough to consume, and so, you know, it's all about that. And what God said, no, this, the principle that you need to live with is abundance. And abundance is that there's more love than you can possibly imagine. And because when you feel it that way, everything changes and you see things differently. I mean, I was just with a guy just 5 minutes ago, and he said, I have been living my life in a dark corner. And he said, you know, I suddenly realized, you know, as we were talking about different things, that I want to change my life. I want to have a difference. Well, anyway, he's decided to uproot himself. He feels the spiritual thing that says, I got to take this new journey. I'm going to move out of here. I'm going to go to Idaho. I'm going to cut back my job. And he keeps getting hedged up. You know, things keep falling apart and everything. And I said, but if the spirit's there, it'll work. And so he keeps struggling with it, and door opens, and things keep happens. And he says, I'm finding a new way to live. Well, just as a perfect example, his friend now is dying. His friend has cancer, and he's loved him, you know. And he said, you know, it was a different experience for me because I'm on a different journey. He said, I didn't know that I could love that much. But when I saw him go, he said, I could not withhold the weeping for what it meant for him to go. And yet, I don't feel the loss. And so we went to the graveside, and we were buried, and we all had these balloons. We had these 100 helium balloons, and they were all white. And he said, it was one of the greatest experiences of my life when we were standing there at the grave and we all let them go. And they were, oh, I went up into the sky. And he said, I knew he was alive. I knew it was okay. I knew it was fine. He said, so that we go on with things. And he says, that before. And I felt this cool breeze, and it came by me. And he said, I had the distinct feeling I needed to turn and look. And he said, I turned and looked, and there was this white helium balloon slowly sinking to the earth behind me that somehow had found a rest in my yard. And he said, I don't know. Years ago, I might think that was just a coincidence. But he said, it wasn't a coincidence, because I felt something different, you know, and it's not the same. It's not the same. So, I don't know. He's not wondering about how little there is. He's thinking, you know, there's much more than I could possibly ever imagine than I thought there were before. And he starts living, like all the spiritual soup. I mean, I think this must be out there. I mean, they talk about it in the universe. Maybe it's being held together by this dark matter, you know. You got all this regular matter, and in the universe it's gravity, and it's all going out from the center, and the Big Bang Theory, and they discover that there's things you can't see because it doesn't reflect light, and so it's dark, and so you can't usually measure it in the same way. But there's more than 90% of matter out there that's holding it together that's not the matter as we know it, but it's dark matter. Well, you know, obviously, I'm sounding like Orson Pratt talking about the ether. You know, and it's all out there in the ether, and that's having something to do with the spirituality that Joseph Smith said was matter that was more refined. Well, I don't know what it is. I don't know what dark matter is. But what I do know is that there is some kind of way that the spiritual kinds of things that we feel, that if you tune into them, they change the way you see things. And you feel things that you wouldn't otherwise do. It's like Obi-Wan Kenobi. You know, the force is with you. I know this is a really weird one, okay? But I, you know, I'm really weird. I'm thinking out of the box. I have these different experiences now, just because I think differently. I go into this restaurant. Actually, the same guy I'm supposed to meet, you know, and he shows up late, you know, and so I'm looking around and say, we got to have a quiet place to sit and talk, okay? So I go in the restaurant and I see, you know, I can't stand the noise of the muzak, and I can't be too close to all the booths and so forth, because we want to have some kind of an intimate conversation. So you look around, and there was a booth that would really work. It was way off to the side. No one was sitting there, and there was no speaker up there playing, you know, great music. So I sit there, and I say, that's the one I want. You know, and so he comes in. I say, it's time to go. And the waitress says, okay, would you like to sit down? In my mind, I say, yes. But we need to sit in that booth. I'm saying this simply in my mind. It's like Obi-Wan Kenobi. These are not the droids that that you want, you know. As they were driving into the Tatooine, you know. I said, these are not the droids that you want. And the guy says, okay, drive on. So I'm sitting and saying, we need that booth. And she looked around. She started walking, and then she stopped. And she turned. She looked at the booth. She said, would you like to sit over there? I said, yes, those are the droids. You know. But, you know, I know, it's weird. I'm going to say, well, that really doesn't matter. I mean, that doesn't count. That isn't part of the spiritual force in the universe. I'm making this up because it's convenient to do that. But every single day, when it feels like you're floating in the way things happen, that are so much more likely to bring you a sense of efficiency about life, I begin to wonder how much all of that is an accident. You know, how much of that doesn't exist in the reality? How much of it really isn't, you know, part of your ability to plug in to the universe of who you are in relationship to the entire sense of what it means to be you? Because when you're you, when you really are Albert Peck being Albert Peck, it's the best thing in the world for everybody. I mean, Sunstone, for instance. I mean, I'm serious. One of the issues about the spirit in Zion is the capacity to have Albert Pecks in the universe. Seriously, I mean, where do people come to be heard? You asked about journeys. You know, whose journey is missed, you know, if we don't have Sunstone? And people who find a different way of connecting, you know, in this kind of situation. I mean, Sunstone does that. And you decided to do this because you're going to get paid well for it. You decided to do this because you were appointed to this by one of the general authorities. You know, you decided to do this because your parents had an expectation that their son would one day wind up leading a sunny organization. You decided to do this because you felt pain and suffering, and you grieved over places where people couldn't find answers and a place to even dialogue about it.
With everyone you read into, I have this great life.
Jan is here to argue that point. She's very quick to say, that's my wife, very quick to say that, no, he does fine on the road, but when he gets home, he's not all that connected. It's like, it's the only place, it's sort of like a shaver, you know, an electric shaver, you know, eventually it runs out and you go home to get plugged in. But unfortunately, when you're being plugged in, you're not doing too much. Probably fair, isn't it? Yeah, she says yes. See, she has to put up with all this connecting everywhere else, and then she's the one where I'm plugged in, and she's got to take care of me, which isn't always fair, you know. But of course we fall off, you know, this whole thing about falling from grace. I don't know. But tell me, you know, what do you think is an illusion? And this, if it isn't too personal. Say that again. Say more. Say what more are you thinking? No. You can't figure it out. Well, tell me where you think the gospel fits into that equation. No, but I think it's important. what I guess I think your question is very important, because to me the central question here for me is, what is truth about this whole illusion or non-illusion about what is life? What is truth? And to me, trying to find that truth has been extraordinarily difficult. I believe in the gospel because I think it tells me that it's after truth too. That its central core thing is it wants to understand everything that was, that is, and that will be, and that all truth can somehow be understood in some kind of fashion. And I found a limitation in my brain's ability to comprehend that. Okay? My cognitive ability seems to be limited as I try to use that. So what I have discovered is John. You know, when he says, how can you love God if you have never loved your fellow man? And so I started out, instead of loving God as the first commandment, which seemed to me to be right, one that I keep not doing very well with, it fell to the second one, which was right. And I think sometimes the projection of those, of sometimes what I want God to be maybe isn't what he is. But if you love your fellow man truly, it was a place where I started to feel a certain kind of what I just, if transcend my pain for a second, and what it felt like was reclaiming my spiritual capacity to reconnect with God, meaning that the spiritual death that the gospel talks about may in part be reclaimed in the capacity to love another as well as we possibly can, a child, a parent, a loved one. And in so, exactly. And it seems to me that the gospel is not about the church. It's about that reclaiming the ability to be like God, which hopefully is this ability to love. Which, if God is love, that's what we're hopefully capable of learning how to do. And so it may be temporally difficult. Again, one of the general authorities was telling me, he said, you know, when it really gets down to it, the church is in a telestial state. It's not a celestial state. You know, it's a place where we're trying to make things work. He said, if you really look at it, the more celestial spot is the family. And whether that works or not, that may or may not be true. But the view is that in a family, you know, you can maybe go beyond what you might have done before. And he used the example of saying, you know, when it comes to the church, the Relief Society and the bishop don't run the ward. He said, you know, it's the presidency that runs the ward. You know, the Relief Society is a support system, as is the primary, as a Sunday school, but there's a presidency, and he says that's a telestial organization in this regard. Not necessarily telestial, particularly, but terrestrial, but it's not celestial. So, you know, but in the family, the husband and wife are joined and united and are indeed together, and are a different kind of a relationship in making that family organization work. And you can do different things because of it that are different. For one thing is, you don't excommunicate your children. You know, and when it comes to certain kinds of problems that children have, and we were actually talking about sexual problems in some of the ways the church has to go about its discipline, is that it said, you know, the church is required to keep a certain kind of place for itself in order that the community of saints feel like there's some kind of standard that they can believe in that has something to do with maintaining who they are as a group. And whatever that sense of it is, that's what the ecclesiastical sense of maintaining a certain kind of standard within the church has to do with, keeping the community able to function together because there's a standard they can all agree on. But when it comes to a family, I said, those are different experiences, you know. And we don't tell you to excommunicate your children. We don't tell you that their pain and their suffering should be treated any way different than the story of the prodigal son. And they said, the family can do that differently. And so, in my sense, the church is trying to create these opportunities for us. But I think in the long run, it has a limitation in its ability to do that. Well, if we go to a gospel principle to try to respond to that, I think the principle, again, is the same one. It has to do with grace and mercy. And that particular point in time, I'm not to judge the parents either. you know, because again, she's in pain and she's struggling, but it's very quick to then, you know, seeing that they're maybe contributing to some of that pain, then I get a little self-righteous and I'm going to judge them. And that's always going wrong. These people are in enormous pain because they have such expectations for their daughter that they have become so exercised about it that in spite of their best selves, they're intrusive and they're controlling and making efforts to try to make things happen and not to times seeing the way things that she sees them. And so it puts them in conflict. So to try to understand their pain and what they're experiencing gives me my best opportunity to say, I agree with you. You know, she's a wonderful girl and you're just feeling so frustrated and you're so frightened for her. I mean, how does that feel? Because in the process of their claiming that love for her, they now have a chance to find a place to come together as opposed to being particularly critical of what they've seen as their best efforts to make the thing work. And it's right. And the point is, with emancipation of any of our kids, there's a place where we have to let go of trying to make our expectations theirs. And that there's a lot more room for talking about experience if we look at principle-based lives instead of just, you know, what we normally think is a cultural rule about what someone ought to do and what someone ought not to do. And it's very, very hard to do that. And it's sometimes very hard to love through our fear that our kids aren't going to do what we expect them to do, and therefore we've got to get more in control of this situation and find that. Well, I think one of the things that helps us with that is humility, you know. And one of the great lessons of life is that we're going to be humble no matter what we do, and we can keep fighting against it. But if we finally accept that humility is the teacher, you know, I give unto men weakness that they may be humble, and if we humble ourselves sufficiently, I'll make weak things strong. Well, it seems to me the humility they're talking about there is that when we're in pain and when we're not being able to accomplish something, the way is hedged up. It's an opportunity to learn something, and it's a place for us to be taught. The joke always is, they said, you know, young people, you know, have all the energy and no wisdom, so they're humble because they don't get it. You know, and when you get old, you have all the wisdom and no energy, and you're humbled again because you can't do it. You know, and it really is that way. You know, you God keeps finding, and I don't God, but the universe of the way things are, it hedges up the way constantly. We're always running into things we can't control and running things we can't change. And our weaknesses get in our way, and our susceptibilities and our genetics and our arthritis or whatever kind of gets in the way. And at some point, I think that, you know, to me, brings us back to having to decide what matters most. You know, there we have to go into our core self and decide, you know, which piece of myself do I finally decide is most important. You know, the fellow who was across the street, who this is a wonderful, wonderful state cancer, and he was, you know, trying so hard to keep himself alive because his wife was ill and she depended on him, and his mother was ill and she depended on him, and they prayed, and you know, he was away on a trip. He had a serious event that made, no, actually I think it was pancreatic illness. Yeah, it was pancreatic. Excuse me, very serious. Anyway, they did surgery, and they did incredible things, and, you know, they felt it was a miracle in his life. And he came back and said, you know, I've had this miracle in my life, and my life has been preserved. And he said, my life is preserved so I can live long enough to take care of my wife before she dies and my mother before she dies. And I mean, this was his vision of what was important. Even with his limitations and with his illness, that was his vision. So, you know, time went on, and his wife passed away. And he was getting a little bit weaker, and he said, nah, but I can hang on there until I take care of my mother. You know, his mother passed away. He said, you know, I fulfilled this the vision. That's important. He says, I will fight for life, but not at the expense of saying that matters more. So, you know, I'm going to do everything I can to bless people's lives as I choose to move out of it. So he set he organized his house. I mean, he got plenty all fixed up so it would look great when he left. We don't all have this much time, but he said, I want this amount of time. And gave all of his grandchildren patriarchal blessings, and he wrote memoirs. I mean, he did all those kind of things. And then he sort of said, you know, now my life is finished. And even at the very end, He said, but what I want to do is I just want, you know, my children around. I don't want to talk. And I, so one day I was over there talking to him, and he said, you know, I know I don't have a lot of energy, but he said, I just want to tell you that I love you. He says, but let me tell you in a very kind of special way. He said, see that box of chocolate over there? He said, those are Cummings chocolates, the best chocolates in the world. Now, he was starving because he couldn't eat anything, right? So he said, you give me a tiny piece of that chocolate. He just put it on his tongue because he couldn't swallow it. He said, and that tastes wonderful. He said, do you want a taste of that too? He said, you can have a chocolate. And there, that moment, that was what he decided mattered most, was ability to share something that was valuable or important or he felt made a difference for him. And it was kind of a chuckle. He was literally lying in bed just completely without any strength. Said, I love you. And it was 2 days later that he died. I don't know. You know, there comes a point where we're finally reduced to making decisions about what matters most in our lives. And I think that humility that comes from our inability to transcend the temporal sense that we can't master it will eventually teach us. And in the psychology of life, it's about what we call integrity versus despair. You start out with trust. You start out with autonomy. You start off with the ability to have industry and intimacy and all of that. But when you finally get to the end of your life, the way the sociologists look at it, you can either have integrity, that is, you come to terms with who you are and you discover that who you are is okay and you believe in yourself and who you are and that you've lived your life with integrity by principle, or despair. Despair is that, you know, it's never going to be good enough. You didn't get what you wanted. It's, you know, your life is taken from you, and somehow you're fighting and thrashing at those last moments to somehow preserve a life that doesn't have meaning because somehow you made some choices about what mattered to you that at this point don't matter at all. Because at that point, money didn't matter to him. At that point, even, you know, food, only to the extent that, you know, he could taste something, mattered. You know, nothing mattered except his kids and his children and his connections.
How much, you know, the Western view is a loss of control, of taking mastery over yourself to get to a point like that, whereas the Eastern view is a lot more accepting who I am with the inherent contradiction. Where do you come down?
Well, I think it's a good question. I mean, what has Mormonism done as a question on that point? As we're talking about things that might relate to the church, where has Mormonism come out on the issue of that kind of more Eastern philosophy about what it means to let go and essentially accept fate and to see things in the context that we don't have control over them, and by accepting them for what they are, we bring a certain peace to our life because we are not about the control. And to be honest with you, I don't find that very often talking to a lot of members of the church. They seem to come more from a position of, you know, industry. You know, we're the beehive state. You know, it all's about what you can do to make things change, as opposed to accepting things that we can't change. And the way I can say is that I've learned it from the sad experience that, just like unrighteous dominion, we have a tendency toward it. At the same time, you have a tendency toward control. It almost always fails. There are very few things we really can control. And so I think I've been taught by experience that long-suffering, meekness, kindness, love unfeigned is that place where the peace really comes. And I think maybe a different way of looking at it, in other words, seeing those terms to mean that kind of acceptance of things that we can't change. I think the problem always is the wisdom to know which is which.
Well, one of the things.
Well, that's a great question. To be really honest with you, I really do think they're struggling with that. And the question is, you know, from Elder Oaks' point of view, you read his article in the Ensign in October of 97 about same gender attraction. And he talked about susceptibilities, where he comes down, and years before, Elder Packer was struggling with this because he tended to be a spokesman, and it comes from the point of view of the church needing to keep the church whole within its moral context, and that is we have to make sure that the church follows the standard. And the problem always was the conflict between the advocacy for people who live with these kinds of challenges, shall we say, and this same-sex attraction, and advocating for an acceptance of them in the situation, and the church's view that accepting the person is accepting the behavior. And so there was the struggle to sort of say, wait a second, we've got to somehow get past that. There's a person and then there's the behavior. And, okay, so what Elder Oaks went on that with that point was to say, there are really, it's not just about anything goes, and everybody comes up with a normal template. There are people who retire, there are people who are this, there are people who are that, and there are people who have a predisposition toward same-sex attraction, and it's a reality, it's a susceptibility. But we don't know if it's genetics entirely. I'm telling you what the position is, okay? We don't know if it's genetics entirely because there are scientists out there who will argue that point. And he quotes some very legitimate literature to that point. And he read it all. I mean, to his credit, he read it all. And he said, no, I don't think it covers the whole water. But even so, there's a certain point where those susceptibilities might lead to feelings, and those feelings toward a same-sex attraction in this particular situation. But there always comes a point of agency when you make a choice about how you act on those feelings. And he said, I don't think it's any different than rage. What about the person who has a tendency toward anger? Maybe they have a tendency toward... And at some point, you know, they get so angry they get into domestic violence. And he sort of said, well, that person, you know, has a depression, and they're very likely to lose control of their anger. At some point, you know, there's a place, and I guess none of us can absolutely know this, where that person's susceptibilities stops and their agency begins, because there's some kind of agency that we all have to make some choices over what we do in our behavior. And at that point, we're accountable. And what Elder Oaks is trying to say is, only God probably knows that. And therefore, we have to be less judgmental about it. But at the same point, we also have to say, don't walk away by making excuses for ourselves when we really have the capacity to take some control over those things that we can control. Because those behaviors that the church is concerned about have inherent downsides to them. And there's reasons for not behaving like losing control of your anger. Or there's reasons for not losing control of your sexuality. And there's reasons for not losing control of your appetite. And even if you have Prader-Willi syndrome, which increases the appetite and makes people overeat, you know, at least the destructive things, that maybe they can't always control that. But to the extent that you can, that's where you're held accountable. Well, one thing I won't do is I'm not going to speak for the brethren. I hope you don't think I'm speaking for Elder Oaks. I'm trying to understand the way he was trying to formulate that issue in the way he talked about it. I can't speak for him, and I'm not speaking for the church, okay? That would be a terrible mistake. Well, I think that the place starts out with some compassion for suffering and trying to make a connection. You know, the story I tell a thousand times is the father whose son who had AIDS was living in San Francisco, and the kid kept saying, can I come home? And his companion had died and he had no one. And the father said, no, you know, can't have you here with that. And it went on and on. And he was like very close. And finally the dad said, he remembered that it was his boy. I remember what it was like when he was little, how much he loved him and how much they'd spend time together, and they'd been on camps, and here's this kid dying. He says he can't come home. And finally he's in this, you know, do I bring him home, you know, because he's done all these things? Or finally he fell on the side of compassion and said, I don't care if it's right or wrong, I just have to have my boy. So he called him. Boy came back, lived in his house for a couple months, you know, died in his arms on the couch. And he said, I don't know what's right or wrong. All I know is that I have my boy back. Well, you know, I know you can make that statement. But what I'm talking about is, right.
Let me move to a different question, though. You're talking about it'd be wrong to let people suffer. Yeah. Many, perhaps most of the gay men I know, more gay men, don't feel like they're suffering. They, at least the younger people who live, come up in a more open age, feel joy, spirituality, self-fulfillment, and they use very positive language to describe their sexual identity, not a negative language.
Right.
So, well, of course, but everyone's ever seen society about this. But in their own personal, individual, this journey you talked about of coming to know yourself, they find a wholeness and an integrity. What do you think about that?
I think it's real. I think for many of them, that's exactly how it is. And I think that we have an enormous challenge ahead of us. You know, let me just ask the question. How can we have a Zion society if everyone isn't a part of it? And I don't know how you create that society if everyone isn't a part of it in some kind of way. I don't know that I have the answer, but I do think that there is some self-affirmation that you're describing about how they're feeling, that somehow we're losing as far as a community if it's not part of who we are, because they are part of who we are. And I don't know how to struggle as a church with it as much as I know how to struggle as a person, which is, you know, yes, fine, you know, let's make those connections and let me not make judgments that limit my opportunity to know people who have that wonderful sense of who they are and who've discovered a journey that I don't understand, but I need to.
Yeah.
Is there another question? Well, I think they're more good than any of us will ever do in this life. I think the issue there is the choice between goods. I think we're all faced with, we really believe in people, because I think people have got to decide where their best good lies. And one of those may simply be that I'm going to contribute to, you know, the Red Cross or whatever. You know, and there's a church fund where you can contribute to that. And I don't know what I'm going to do about the starving people in Ethiopia. But I certainly feel like, you know, on Fast Sunday I can ask, put some more money into that particular coffer. But on a larger circumstance, I don't think the answer can come from what I can do or know. There's something about the atonement I just have to have some faith in. You know, that there's something beyond my ability to understand what it means to take that amount of suffering and make some sense out of it. All I want to do, at least in my part, is not to be a part of it in creating it. And so on a day-to-day basis, somehow transmit the sense of connection constantly to the people I'm with and limit the judgment. That my job is more about mercy than it is about judgment, and leave the judgment up to God.